Going Linux, episode 171, Computer America, number 49. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, Computer America.
You're listening to Computer America.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. It's Tuesday, the 17th of April, 2012, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And it is the third Tuesday of the month, and means it's going to be our all Linux show. Everything you want to know about Linux and then some. Let's get right to it. I mean, it's all about Linux. And, of course, as you all know, or most of you know or should know, that the Linux operating system continues to be more and more popular. And, of course, the question is Linux right for you? I know my son, Aaron, is a dedicated Linux user. He doesn't even have Windows anymore. He just uses Linux and absolutely loves it. It's an important operating system, so as I said, every third Tuesday of the month, we devote the entire show to the subject of Linux in order to answer questions is Linux right for you? And if you have a Linux question, tonight's the night for you to give us a call. Joining us is our Linux expert, Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. Larry, welcome into Computer America. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Craig. Yeah. Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
Doing good.
That's exactly. So Linux continues to be the a very popular populating operating system.
There yeah. you go. we know what you mean.
It was easy for me to say. And we're going to talk all about it. Now, every month I ask Larry to give us a particular topic. Last month we talked about GPod or podcasting, cross-platform podcasting Linux. Before that, it was like, you know, installing Linux. What are the options? We had many, many different topics. During the holidays, holiday gift giving, donating to the open source projects. So these are some of the tonics. So one topic was Linux. It doesn't always work, you know.
Right.
If all these different topics, you know, the topic that we're going to be talking about tonight, and this is directly quoted from what Larry sent me. It says, "Adjust your thinking. Adjust your thinking." To make using Linux easier. Adjust your thinking to make using Linux easier. So what do you mean by that?
Well, just as when you move from Windows to the Mac or Mac to Windows for that matter, you need to start thinking about things a little bit differently because the operating system just operates differently. Things are in a different place. You do things in a different way. Same thing applies to Linux. And it just helps to not abandon your old thinking if you're moving from Windows to Linux or from Mac to Linux, but just realize as you are trying to figure out how to use this new strange operating system that expect things will be a little bit different. And what I'd like to talk about in our first hour here is just some of the things that you might need to think differently about when beginning to use Linux for the first time.
Okay. And it's interesting because there are some things that you have to adjust when you because there are some large differences between using Linux and using a different operating system like Windows. Although there are things you can put on it to make it look a lot like Windows and what have you.
Yep, yep.
Still, there are some definite adjustments you have to make. And I guess adjust your thinking to make using Linux easier, I guess, is a good topic for tonight. So we're kind of focused on new for this topic is really adjusted toward new people, new users
yes,
of Linux.
Exactly right. Okay. And that's where the Going Linux podcast focuses in on. Although we do have the more advanced episodes where we go into depth in a topic. Most of our topics are focused around helping new Linux users adjust to the new environment. And that's kind of our specialty. There are plenty of other podcasts out there for Linux, everything from Linux news to in-depth how to use the command line to get things done. But our focus is on helping new users to adapt to the new environment, and that's what we're doing here today.
Yes. Now, and so let's kind of start it off. And what are some of the things that people should be thinking about to help make using Linux easier?
Sure. So the first one is targeted directly at those people who have been using Windows for a long time, and people who have moved over from Windows or moving over for a number of reasons, not the least of which is they're tired of all the viruses and the anti-spyware that you have to keep up on, yeah. And the fact that that stuff slows things down. One of the key things that is very, very different is that when you install new software on Linux, let's say you're installing Skype or you're installing a different word processor or any software, you don't have to reboot after you do the installation. Hmm. That's kind of classic Windows. In order to get Windows to complete the installation of an application, of a software package, you need to restart Windows. With Linux, you don't. And I suspect that it's the same thing on the Mac, is that when you install something, it just knows that it's there and you can start using it right away. You don't have to restart your computer.
That's true with Windows when you do an installation.
I thought that was a universal truth, that every computer had to restart just to, you know, kind of put it in its place after you've installed it. But
nope, not at all.
Weird.
Yeah, it is. Also, on the Mac too, there's a lot of things you'll install, unless it's something really low level, or a utility of some sort. Most applications that you start, you don't have to restart the computer. You install the application and you just run with it and you start using it.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that's primarily the reason why Linux and the Mac are so similar in that regard, is mm-hmm. they both are based on the Unix operating system, mm-hmm. and the Mac being based on BSD, which is based on Unix, and Linux is based on Unix as well, mm-hmm. so they do have some common roots, and so there's a lot of commonality in the way things work between those two operating systems,
yes.
at least.
And of course, we're talking about OS 10, because before that, OS 9 and OS 8 and OS 7, all those other ones, they were really had problems. I mean, system bombs, and I mean, it was very, OS 10 truly brings stability to the Mac operating system, and it really does a heck of a job.
Thanks to its Unix roots.
There you go. And that's it. All right, listen, music means we can take a break, and then we'll continue on. We're just getting started. This is the Computer America Show. It's all about Linux tonight. 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number. Love to hear from you. Stay with us. And it's 22 minutes after the hour here on the Computer America Show. 866-606-8255. Live at ComputerAmerica.com or our chat room at ComputerAmerica.com. Ben and I are talking to Larry Bushy. He's the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast, and we're just getting started on the topic of adjusting your thinking to make using Linux easier. And why don't you continue on, Larry?
Sure. So before the break, we were talking about the fact that you don't need to reboot Linux after installing the typical software.
Yeah.
And yes, if it's something like a new kernel or a base level utility, sometimes you do have to mm-hmm. reboot, because that is, you know, the heart of the system. But for something like reinstalling your browser or reinstalling Skype another normal package.
So you're saying with Windows, when you install Skype or you install a browser, you have to reboot Windows?
You know something, sometimes it asks you to reboot and sometimes it doesn't, and I'm not sure why or where or, you know, all those reasons, but what Windows users get in the habit of doing is, because you're not sure, you reboot anyway. Right?
Yeah.
And I use Windows at work because I have to, and I do the same thing. I don't know whether it requires a reboot. Some of them do, some of them don't. I restart every time I install something. And certainly if it's something like Microsoft Office, it definitely requires a reboot. So in Linux, you can actually be using your browser install an upgraded version of that same browser while you're using the old version. Continue to use the old version after the installation is finished. Close the browser, and when you reopen it, it will start up the new version for you that you just installed.
Wow. Well, it is. Okay.
Yeah, it's rock solid.
Yeah, it is.
So the second thing that I have on our list of things that you need to think about or think differently about is look before you buy. And what I mean by that is, unlike with both Windows and the Mac, typically when you're looking for a professional, full-fledged, up-to-date, current software package to get something done, you look online and you make a purchase, or you go to the app store for the Mac, or whatever it's called these days, or you go to the store and pick up a box of software that has a CD in it.
Yeah.
And with Linux, the nice thing about Linux is the fact that when you are looking for software applications, much like you would look in the App Store for software for your Mac, you can look in the software repositories or the software store, whatever it's called on your Linux distribution, and you can find lots and lots and lots of software. Even better, most of it is free, which is why you need to look in your software repositories before you go purchasing anything, because you can find complete office suites, several different kinds of office suites. Some of them are capable of opening any Microsoft Office file and saving back to that format, even the most recent versions of Microsoft Office. Some of them are more basic, but you can usually find what it is you're looking for just looking in the software repositories. And if you can't find it there, there are plenty of Linux vetted Linux application stores around that you can look in and download a copy, or even from the developer's website itself, download a copy of that particular application for Linux. And for the most part, 99% of the software for Linux these days is free of charge.
Yeah, but and that to me is an amazing thing, because of course, I mean, there's a lot of freeware out there, don't get me wrong, and also shareware, but the really big ones and the important ones you're usually going to wind up paying for on
exactly,
the Mac, on the
right.
Mac platform, and of course, certainly on the Windows platform, but also on the Mac platform. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of free programs out there, and they're very, very good. A lot of, you know, and of course, there's some shareware products out there as well. Usually with the freeware and shareware, you don't get very much support, whereas when you buy a program, obviously you have a number to call if you need help with it, and that's certainly comforting to know. But
right, and you know, Linux and its applications are certainly not freeware or shareware in the traditional sense of the word, in the way you describe it when you're using Windows or the Mac. It is open source software. Or free as in freedom software. I've heard it described as community-supported software, which is probably a very, very accurate description of what it is. Linux and its applications are supported by the community that uses it, and there are plenty of very large companies using Linux and the software applications that go along with it, and classic Linux software that is for free, Linux application software that's for free, is also available for other platforms like the Firefox browser, like the LibreOffice and OpenOffice office suites that include spreadsheets and word processors and presentation software and databases and things like that. So these software packages, software applications that are available for free, don't think shareware, don't think virus-ridden freeware that may be out there. Think high-quality, professional-quality, up-to-date, modern software applications.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And and another good way example of adjusting your thinking to make using Linux easier. Yeah, so that's two very good reasons.
Right, and the third one is that you can have the latest software, and we've kind of touched on that when we've been talking about look before you buy. But much of the software that's available for Linux, not all of it, some of it's been around for ages and ages and hasn't been updated, but that's because in many of those cases, it's already very good software and doesn't need any further development. But there are constant updates to many, if not most, of the software that's out there for Linux, for the Linux operating system. Mm-hmm. And the applications that are most popular tend to be the ones that get the most attention. And so Linux itself is a very modern operating system. It has its roots in a very old operating system, mm-hmm. Unix. But that just helps to make it stable. But mm-hmm. It's truly up-to-date and modern.
All right, a modern operating system. You know, we should come back and define what we mean by a modern operating system these days.
Sure.
This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. It's all about Linux, 866-606-TALK. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Computer America Show. Larry Bushy continues on with us. Mm-hmm. And right before the break, we were kind of discussing how Linux is considered a modern operating system. Because I know even I'm guilty of this sometimes. I think that some distributions of Linux are what you put onto a computer after its specs have fallen behind of, you know, what's kind of acceptable for, say, Windows 7 or Windows 8, and you need something a little bit more lightweight, you put it on those older systems. But Linux is not for, you know, just the old computers and running old programs.
No, that's a good perception.
That's exactly right. And when you do install some of those lighter weight Linux distributions, typically the way they get them to be lighter weight is they cut back on some of the modern features, some of the graphical features that make user interfaces so attractive these days, and you end up with something that in some cases looks a little bit like Windows 95 or something like that in its user interface. Now, under the hood, it's just as powerful as any other Linux. It's just that on older hardware, sometimes it just can't handle. The graphics is usually the issue that it can't handle, and so you cut back on that, and some of the graphical things just go away, but it's still a very powerful system. And if you do have a new modern computer, and I'd say anything within the past couple of years would be classified as modern, you can install something like Linux Mint or Ubuntu or Fedora or some of the distributions of Linux that are designed for the new Linux user and also for the Linux user that wants something modern. You'll take a look at Ubuntu. It has a very modern user interface that is completely different from Windows, completely different from Macintosh, and completely different from most other traditional desktop computers. You'll find that it's very similar to what you might want to find on a tablet. Or a tablet computer or something like that, but it's adapted for the desktop environment. You look at Linux Mint, it has a lot of nice graphical features, transparency and a lot of the kinds of features that you tend to think of as Mac-ish features, and yet it is very attractive in its own way, very distinct, very different. And as you think about modern, you think about the visual aspect of modern, but there's also the power behind it. The applications themselves are just as up-to-date as you can find on any other operating system out there, Mac, Windows, anything. And, you know, a lot of the same applications are available. We've talked about browsers, Firefox, Chrome, Opera. They're all available for Linux as they are for the other operating systems. And in many cases, they have exactly the same features. They look exactly the same. Or in some cases, they have a few different features. They take advantage of some of the things that Linux can do that the other operating systems can't. And so they really do take the power of your computer and take advantage of it, just as you would expect with any modern operating system.
Right. And when we talk about a modern operating system, I think there it's a couple of things to keep in mind, and that is primarily things like protected memory. That's one mm-hmm. of the features of it used to be when an application would die for some reason or explode, it would bring the whole operating system down to its knees.
And, right, right.
And you had to today's operating systems have sometimes a feature called protected memory. So when an application malfunctions in one way, you'll quit out of it, but the operating system is working fine because it's in a protected area of memory, you know, and so it doesn't bring the whole operating system crashing down. As a matter of fact, I can't remember the last time that I've had something interact so badly that it's pulled the whole operating system down. It's just
didn't you set your phone on your trackpad or something in it?
Yes, I was just going to say. Not my phone, my wallet. I put my wallet on my trackpad and not thinking about it. And, of course, the trackpad is very low level. And so the wallet was sitting on the trackpad and it was sending this mouse interaction with it. Didn't actually bring the operating system. Had I just removed my wallet from the trackpad, everything would have restored to normal. It was just overloading it because it's such a low-level device, and I couldn't really do anything until I finally I figured out what had happened. So it really didn't bring the operating system down. Had I just taken it off the trackpad, it would have been fine.
Wow. So, yeah. So was it the pressure of the wallet on the trackpad?
Yeah, it was touching it. Just like I took my whole hand.
I thought for a moment there it was RFID chips in your credit cards or something.
No. It's a touch sensitive trackpad, and the whole wallet was sitting. It was like my holding my whole hand on it, and it was just stopping the computer from doing anything. It didn't really bring it down. Had I just removed it, everything would have been fine again. When I finally realized what it was, I removed it and everything worked perfectly again.
Right. So yeah, in the old days of Windows 95, it probably would have blue screened on
you.
Yeah, right?
Probably that. But exactly. But the thing is, so the protected memory is another thing. Then there's also multi-threaded. It's multi-threaded. Multitasking, multi-threaded. So you can do multiple things at the same time. It used to be where you only do one application at a time. Then they had something called the multi-finder, which would sort of simulate that. But with the modern operating system, truly you can do many, many things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, because that was probably – I think it was before – Ben ever – what was the first operating system that you used, Ben? What version of Windows was it?
Oh, either 95 or the one right before that.
Okay, all right. So Windows 95, I think, was already a modern operating system, so you could do multiple things at the same time. But in the earlier days, Ben, you could run one thing at a time, and that was it. You wanted to run something else, you had to shut down the other thing and then start the other thing.
I could barely even run one thing at a time. I mean, the computer we had it bogged down. Like, of course, me and Aaron were like 4 and 6 or something like that. So we downloaded everything that we found on the internet. We installed all this junk software, and it just slowed it to a crawl.
So,
and things have certainly changed. And
yes, they have.
Linux can take advantage of all of those technological changes. Yeah. If you have 2, 4, 6, 8, 16 gigabytes of RAM, it can address all of that, with a 32-bit version of the operating system. And, of course, there are 64-bit versions of the operating system available. Mm-hmm. So all of that, it can take advantage of all the advanced hardware and make use of the computer as you expect it to.
And multiple cores now?
Multiple cores. Mm-hmm. The computer that I have in the shop being fixed is a 4-core i5. You know, and it takes advantage of all of that. And I have my choice of running 64 or 32-bit Linux on there, and either one works just wonderfully.
There you go. All right. So another reason, that's the third reason why to adjust how to adjust your thinking to make using Linux easier.
Yeah. And another hallmark of Linux and free and open source software is the fact that you can copy, share, and even give away the operating system and its applications to all your friends without breaking the law. and, you know, some people don't worry about that. You know, they just make a copy of their Microsoft Office CD and hand it over to their friends and say, hey, I got this, you know, I got this deal here for you. Well, that you're violating Microsoft's terms of use. And with the Linux operating system and its applications, the free and open source licenses that these software packages are licensed under allows you to use the software any way you like, to copy it, to share it, to give it away. You can even sell it to someone and still not be breaking any of the licensing rules around the open source software license.
How does someone get away with that? You can sell the software
But there's nothing preventing you from selling it. And if someone's willing to buy it from you, monetary exchange can take place. In fact, one of the websites that I direct people to when they're trying to make decisions about, or at least trying to find information about what distributions of Linux are available, is distrowatch.com. And DistroWatch rates each of the Linux distributions, or the more recent Linux distributions, and they're rated by how many people click on the information to find out about them. So there, it's kind of user self-sustaining ratings, if you will. But as you look on the right-hand side of their website, you'll see the ratings, but right above the ratings, you'll see a place where you can purchase CDs of those very free operating systems that you're getting ratings on. So they are for sale, and typically they're essentially just covering the cost of publishing the CD itself. So it's like $5, $10, something like that. So it's certainly not $200 and some odd that you would pay for a full boat license of Windows. But there's nothing stopping you from taking free as in freedom, software like Linux and selling it.
Well, there you go. So four excellent reasons. And adjusting your thinking to making using Linux easier. And and we're going to continue on. We've got another break coming up, and then we'll continue on with this. But certainly something to think about. And again, if you're new to the Linux operating system, and these are considerations that you should be taking advantage of, because they do make things a lot simpler and easier to move over to the Linux operating system. We're going to take a break. 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number. Larry Bushy here with us for both hours talking about Linux. We're talking about adjusting your thinking to make using Linux easier. And he's come up with four really good reasons as to why that would be a great idea. I mean, all of them are help support you to moving to the Linux operating system. And I really
right,
do
exactly.
Like, yeah. And I think that they're, all of them are good. You got a fifth one for us?
I do. I have four more, actually. Right, hopefully we can get them in the next few minutes. The next one is you can use Linux for whatever purpose you want. There are no restrictions. And what I mean by that is if you look at the Windows EULA, the End User License Agreement, there are some very strict restrictions as to what you can use the Windows operating system to do. So, for example, if you wanted to put Windows on the internet and allow someone to log in remotely to Windows 7, let's say, that would be contrary to the Windows End User License Agreement. You couldn't do that. You could do that with Linux if you wanted to. You could do anything with Linux if you wanted to. You can use it to do something that it wasn't designed to do. In fact, you can, if you're a developer or a programmer, you can reprogram it to do whatever you want, and you are not in violation of any laws, rules, restrictions, end user license agreements, or anything else. The licensing around Linux, most Linux applications, or excuse me, the Linux operating system itself, and many of the applications, is free, as in freedom, to the point where you have the right to do what you want with it, to use it for any purpose without restriction.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is nice.
The sixth one, I guess we're on six now, is you don't have just one choice. If you don't like it, change it. And I'm talking about the operating system itself, any of the application packages that are installed. You can install whatever you like. If you don't like the word processor, you can uninstall it and install another one. There are hundreds of them out there for Linux. And you find the one that's right for you and you use it. If you don't like the way that Linux is set up, change it. If you don't, if you want something out of the box that's set up the way that you want it, take a look at distrowatch.com. There are hundreds of Linux distributions out there, mm-hmm. and a distribution of Linux is Linux is Linux. It is the operating system itself. It is the kernel of the operating system, and each distribution is a different packaging of what goes into Linux. It may have different utilities. It may have different software installed out of the box. It may have the Chrome browser instead of Firefox. It may have Oracle's OpenOffice instead of LibreOffice. And you can find all kinds of different things, lightweight, heavyweight things, versions of Linux, distributions of Linux that are designed for musicians. You can find anything that you want, and just look for it. You'll find it, and it's out there. Sometimes the choices are overwhelming, but you have the choices. You're not restricted.
How hard is it to move like all your private documents from one distro to another?
Oh, very, very easy. All of the Linux distributions have something called a home directory, very similar to what the Mac does. And so you have your user directory in Linux that contains not only your personal documents, but also many of the configuration files, most of the configuration files for the applications themselves. So if you copy, if all you do is back up your home directory, put it on an external hard drive, install your new Linux distribution, and then copy over what you've backed up. If you had any preferences set for your browser, any bookmarks, any things like that, they would all move with it, provided you're using the same browser, of course. Your word processor, all of your settings would be there. Any application that would you would – even if it wasn't there to begin with and you installed it on the new version of Linux afterwards, your preferences from your home directory would be there. So it's very, very easy. Simple, simple, simple.
There you go.
Very nice.
All right. So do we have one more? We got less than a minute.
We got a couple more, but let's just go to this one. Support is just a Google search away. Ask your friends in the Linux community for support. Yeah. Google is your friend. Just type in your error message, and you'll find all kinds of forums for your distribution or other distributions. And don't just think that you have to stick with your distribution solutions. Linux is Linux. Many of the solutions will work across different distributions.
Okay. And the last one?
The last one, last but not least, is the terminal is not just to enter commands for fixing things. It is a powerful tool in Linux. It's not a vestigial remnant of what used to be command line stuff,
right,
as it's become in Windows. It is a powerful tool. There are applications developed specifically to be run in a terminal, and there's a lot of power hidden under that black screen with white text.
Yeah. and of course, on the Mac too, there's a terminal mode too that allows you.
Of course,
to do,
and many of the same commands are common.
Yeah, very common command structure, and I know there are books on using terminal to do things. Although I have to say, I find myself using it less and less these days. I mean, there's so many utilities and things that will just kind of do it for me, you know.
Oh, sure, and the same thing on Linux. As Linux has developed into its current state of modern operating system,
right?
I think it's not required that you know the terminal anymore.
No.
But it certainly helps. Really does.
I mean, I can copy batches of files now with a program. I had some invisible files I wanted to make visible. I mean, I could use terminal, but now there's a program that just does that for me, and it actually does it so much better than my having to type it in with the terminal.
And faster.
And it's just easier. So, and pretty much, so if I want to do something now that's on a command line or I need the terminal, you know, what I find myself doing first is going to Google and finding if there's a utility that will do it for me.
Exactly.
And 99.9 times out of 100, I mean, there is. You know, someone's had a need for it, and they do it, and they do a better job with it, you know, than I could do it on the terminal. So it's really extremely rare that I use it. But, you know, it's there if you want it and to learn how to do it. And, of course, Linux has it as well. And, and it is. All right. Well, now coming up in the next hour, we're going to read some emails. We've got emails that we've collected, an interesting collection of emails that we do that Larry saves throughout the month and then comes back, and we'll be reading those here on the Computer America Show.
You're listening to Computer America. Computers run the world, and we run computers. Call us toll-free, 866-606-TALK. That's 866-606-TALK. Or send us an email to live@computeramerica.com.
Hello and welcome into hour two of the nation's longest-running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm still your co-host, Ben.
And we continue on with Larry Bushy. He's the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. It's the third Tuesday of the month, and we dedicate the entire show, both hours, to the subject of Linux. And in the first hour, we talked about adjust your thinking to make using Linux easier. And Larry came up with like six or seven really good reasons why to do that. We're going to continue on, but we're going to shift gears slightly, and we're going to go to the email. Larry has collected a number of emails over the month, and we're going to address some of them here tonight on the Computer America Show. So if you want to start it off, Larry.
Okay.
We can do that. Let's start off with Ian, I believe.
Right. So Ian asked about something called multiple X sessions. Let me read his brief email, and then I'll explain what that means.
Okay.
Ian writes, "Hi, everyone. Great podcast. I've been listening since the first show and always, all in capitals, always learn something new each time. In episode 167, listener feedback, Sean mentioned the ability to run multiple X sessions. Are there any associated show notes that you could include detailing how this is done? Best regards," and he doesn't sign it Ian, he signs it Mad Woolly Thing. So, Mad Woolly Thing. Well, let me describe what X sessions are. So, you can think of it as multiple user sessions, if you will. But unlike logging in as two different users at the same time, which you can do on many operating systems out there, what multiple X sessions is it allows you to log in as any user on different screens at the same time. So you could log in as the same user using an entirely different window manager if you wanted to. X is the name of the essentially the windowing system that, that Linux uses. And so when you start two X sessions, essentially you have two completely independent sessions of Linux running on the same machine. And you could be logged in as the same user or different users. And that's what Ian is asking about. So getting to Ian's question, do we have any show notes about this? We, in a more recent episode than 167, we did cover multiple X sessions, a very recent episode. And in fact, if you'll indulge me, Carlos in the next email describes a little bit about that.
Okay.
And looks at episode 167 as well.
Right.
So Carlos provides an explanation about X sessions, just as Ian had asked about. So perhaps Carlos's email will answer Ian's question.
Okay.
Carlos writes, "Hello to the trio, Larry, Tom, and Bill. Tom and Bill are my two co-hosts. And actually, Tom is my co-host and Bill is our chief executive minion." So that's his official title, executive minion. Carlos continues, "Regarding episode 167's debate about the multiple logins and multiple X sessions, I have a few cents to add. Even though both operating systems, that is Windows and Linux, can switch users, with Linux, two or more X sessions can always coexist and remain active. In the other operating system, that is Windows, you need the server version to allow a limited number of X sessions, or whatever they're called, to coexist actively. A regular W client swaps, by the way, W is on the Going Linux podcast our way of saying Windows.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Saying Windows, okay. A regular W client swaps one desktop session for another and keeps the swapped out session frozen. Any running program in the frozen session stops until this desktop session becomes active again. This may not matter to most home users, but this would be a huge drag in my university lab, where at times up to a dozen OpenSUSE workstations, OpenSUSE is a distribution of Linux, are shared as desktops and computing servers. OpenSUSE has always had very convenient switch user icons in KMenu and the screen lock, which create new sessions at Control-Alt-F8, Control-Alt-F9. Those are the key commands you would use to switch between the various X sessions. For example, one student may be working in the morning, setting up a simulation and starting it, then go to class in the afternoon, locking the screen. During the afternoon, a summer student shares the desk and wants to search for literature or write her report on the same computer. She simply clicks Switch User on the locked screen and starts a new X session, which may be a little slower, but is still fast enough. When she is done, she logs out. Then the grad student returns, unlocks the screen, and sees the result of the completed simulation. A similar issue happens with remote access. During a remote desktop session, no user can locally use a W box. It remains locked. If a student in my lab is using a machine without running a simulation, another student may start a remote X session, even from home, and run a simulation in the background, making much better use of the CPU power. For fast remote X sessions, we use no machines, NX, free as in beer. And he includes a link. We should probably put that in the show notes. It's nomachine.com, and no machine is a remote login software that allows you to do just what Carlos is talking about.
I see Ben. I see Ben is copying it right now, and
I can see that as well. Very nice. Isn't Google Docs wonderful? So Carlos wraps up. He says, "There, this should be worth more than 2 cents. Keep it up, Carlos. University of Alberta, Edmonton, Canada."
There you go. All right. Well, good. Good answer.
Yeah, and so what this illustrates is the fact that Unix and Linux and Mac OS X are all designed as multi-user operating systems, unlike the non-server versions of Windows, which are designed as a single-user office or homes operating system. So Linux is designed by design is made as a multi-user system, which means that you can have multiple X sessions, you can have multiple users logged in simultaneously, and everything runs continuously on all of those sessions, unlike as Carlos describes it for Windows, where whatever your active session is running and everything else just stops.
Right. Okay, so that hopefully that and again, W stands for Windows, but Carlos basically answered Ian's email and did it quite well, I thought. So
I think so. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Right. It's great with our users and listeners to the Going Linux podcast, because we do, much like at Computer America, you have the chat room going. We have a constant barrage of email back and forth, and we have a forum as well where our users can get together and banter back and forth and discuss these things and share ideas. And we have many listeners helping out many other listeners with answers to questions. So this is a typical example of what we've got.
All right. Excellent. Do you want to start off with Richard's email? It's short, but we'll probably have to stop you in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's okay. We've done that before.
Okay.
All right. So Richard says and lets us know first that he's solved his problem. He had a problem, and he's letting us know he solved it. He says, "Hi, Larry. I wrote you a while back about the PDFs my computer was creating in Linux Mint 12 with the print to file and print to PDF feature. Those PDF files were not readable in Windows. You looked into it but could not find a direct solution. I thought you might be interested in how I finally solved it. It seems like only some people have this problem, but I know from the Linux Mint forums that at least some other people do. At the advice of some people on the forum, I simply removed and installed cups, and we'll discover what that means after we come back.
All right. You're listening to the Business Talk Radio Network, and we're listening to Computer America on the Business Talk Radio Network. 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number. It's all about Linux. Larry Bushy is our guest for both hours. We'll continue on with the Richard's email when we come back. Stay with us. Twenty-one minutes after the hour here on the Computer America Show. We continue on with Larry Bushy, and we're reading the emails. And we started off with Richard, and why don't we continue on with that?
Okay, and so Richard had talked about the fact that he had solved the problem with PDF files created by his Linux Mint operating system not being readable in Windows, and he said, at the advice of someone on the forum, I simply removed and reinstalled CUPS. And, of course, CUPS is the common Unix printing system, and it is common to any Unix-based operating system, Mac, OS X, Unix, Linux all included, BSD as well. And so he writes down the three commands that he used, and here's an example of command line stuff that's really, really quick. He wrote sudo apt-get remove cups-pdf, and then sudo apt-get install cups-pdf. And Linux has an installer for these programs, and you could have clicked on the menu, clicked on the installer, clicked to update, go find the, you know, I mean, it's several clicks, several bits of typing, open the terminal, and two commands later, and you've got it uninstalled and reinstalled in a flash. So, completing Richard's email, he says, the print to file feature still had the problem with the PDF, previously print to PDF, excuse me, I read that wrong. He said the print to file feature still has the problem, but the PDF feature now works. I am guessing this might be because it reinstalled with a newer version of CUPS, but I'm not really sure. Maybe you know. Thanks for the show.
Okay.
And it is quite possible that the CUPS component responsible for the PDF is what got reinstalled, looking at the commands he used, and it could very well be that there was an updated version of that that the software updater hadn't caught up with, and by manually uninstalling and reinstalling, he got the more recent version. There's also the possibility that it was not installed correctly to begin with, and there could have been some reasons for that. Maybe the distribution, when they sent it out, had made a mistake. Perhaps it got corrupted during the installation. I mean, these things happen sometimes. I'm not really sure either, Richard, but it's always interesting to guess.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm glad it's working for you now. That's the key thing.
Excellent. All right. Well, good. All right. So another problem solved. Let's move on to Rich, who has a comment about the PAE kernel for Linux. What is PAE?
Okay, I don't remember what PAE stands for, but what it is it's a kernel version. So there's the Linux kernel, and you can install a version of the Linux kernel that's called PAE. And what it does is it allows you to use a 32-bit kernel and still address more than 2 gigabytes of RAM and take advantage of multiple processors and multiple core processors as well, which you typically can't do in a 32-bit Windows environment, for example. Four gigabytes of RAM would be the limit. With a PAE kernel, you can address up to, I think it's 256 gigabytes of RAM. I'm not sure what you would use all that RAM for, but I'm sure somebody would find a use for it. And you can, with the PAE kernel 32-bit, you can use all the cores on an i5 or an i7 processor just as you would expect on a modern operating system. So that's what the PAE kernel is.
Got it.
Physical address extension.
Thank you. I knew you and Google would be paired up on this one.
I had it waiting for like 2 minutes, but I wanted to...
Well in advance. Thank you. All right, so shall we get to Rich's email? Yes. He said he made a comment about the PAE kernel for Linux that, as I said in the note here, it lets you address more than 4 gigabytes of RAM with a 32-bit processor. He wrote, "Hi, everyone. I've been using a PAE kernel, misspelled kernel, in the OSs on my 3-core Phenom since I boosted the RAM to 6 gigabytes. If you haven't seen the Wikipedia article, it is excellent. I still do not quite trust the 64-bit systems, as I find Linux applications are sometimes a little behind the curve. Probably just paranoia." I think so, Rich. "But unless the PAE kernel starts giving me problems, why change? One thing to keep in mind is that although the architecture allows the OS to address the RAM as if it were a 36-bit system, I think, or a 64 gigs rather than 4 gigabytes, I'm not sure where he gets the 36 bits, but maybe so. It still operates like a 32-bit architecture from the standpoint of operating any single piece of software. Therefore, any one program can still address 4 gigabytes. Not likely that this is a problem for anything other than a desktop supercomputer or rendering farm, Rich." Oh, and a little asterisk. "Addresses doubling with each additional bit, 8, 16, 32, 64. Okay, so that may be where he comes up with 36. No, must be 32 he's talking about. Yeah. I'm a little confused on that one myself. But essentially what he's saying there is that with a 32-bit operating system, even though you're using the PAE kernel and it does allow you to address larger amounts of RAM, any single program can only use 4 gigabytes. So if you're rendering video and you need multi-core processor, it'll allow you to use the multi-cores of the processor. But if it's going to consume more than 4 gigabytes of RAM, you're probably better off using a 64-bit kernel, which is quite possible with Linux. They do make 64-bit kernels of all of the Linux distributions that I can think of, and they all work wonderfully. They really do.
All right. There you go. Another satisfied user.
Not a customer, there you go. I guess. Right. Non-paying customer.
There you go.
There we go.
Now, go ahead, Ben. You were going to say something?
What? No,
I heard you. It sounded like you were starting to say something.
No.
No, okay.
I heard you. I thought you were saying something.
Yeah, I did.
Well, the whole thing with bits never really kind of clicked in my head for me. Like, I really don't understand what the difference between a 32-bit program and a 64-bit program. Like, why would it matter on an operating system?
Wow. Well, we want to talk about that when we come back?
Sure.
Larry? Okay. All right. All right. This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network, 866-606-8255. That's 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number. Live at ComputerAmerica.com or our chat room at ComputerAmerica.com. Larry Bushy continues on with us. It's all Linux tonight. Stay with us.
For the topic at hand, I asked probably an obvious question for most people. What was really the difference between a 32-bit and a 64-bit operating system? And you guys are about to explain it to me, which will probably make me feel really ridiculous, but please delve into my ignorance.
No.
Oh, believe me, it's not something that most people know about, so your question is spot on. And I have to admit that I am not an expert in this area. I don't pretend to be an expert in this area. And so I have provided 2 Wikipedia article links for our show notes that I will be relying on in addressing this question. So the 32-bit versus 64-bit question is something that we talked about on the Going Linux podcast recently as well. And my co-host Tom had summarized a nice image of think about copper wires. So with a 32-bit system, think about the fact that you have 32 wires that you can in parallel send information down. With the 64-bit system, you have twice as many. And so you can do twice as much. You know, we're stretching the example here a little bit. But you can do a lot more simultaneously with 64 bits than you can with the 32 bits. And so things like addressing more memory simultaneously, handling larger file sizes, just processing more information all at once as opposed to having to do it in bits and pieces. And those are really the major differences between 32 bits and 64. It's just that it can handle more information faster because it can address it all at once as opposed to handling it in serial. And I'm not talking about Captain Crunch here. I'm talking about one thing after another, meaning serial.
Yeah, I actually found this article during the break, and it I guess it attempts to answer, you know, kind of answer this question, but it still left me more confused than anything. But apparently, it's the width of the CPU's register,
right?
Which I guess you kind of implied it to copper wires and having more of them, and Your explanation makes more sense to me than this article did. I was going to quote something from this, but I think that just muddied the issue some more. I did find out, though, that Nintendo 64, that old gaming console,
mm-hmm.
was a 64-bit operating operating system.
Sure.
Way back in 2000.
Right. And we talked about PAE as well, a physical address extension, and I'd just like to correct a couple of things that I said. I think I corrected as well that it will allow you with a 32-bit processor to address more than 4 gigabytes of RAM. I think I originally said 2. But I think I had also said that it will allow you to go up to 256 gigabytes. That's wrong. It'll allow you to go up to 64 gigabytes.
Right.
The 256 comes in, and this is where my memory was playing a trick on me. Mm-hmm. The 64-bit processor can address up to 256 terabytes of memory. So that gives you an example of how much more powerful a 64-bit processor is than a 32-bit processor just by that very feature itself. And another thing that the PAE physical address extension Wikipedia article mentions is that PAE is supported not only in Linux and Unix, but in Mac OS X and in Windows. However, you can turn it on in Windows, but on desktop Windows, it still is limited to 4 gigabytes. And it implies in here, if it doesn't state it directly, that the dear folks at Microsoft have intentionally put that limit in place, something about trademarks or restrictions or some other such proprietary stuff. So I don't pretend to understand what that's all about, but suffice it to say, you can get a PAE kernel for Windows. It just doesn't do much for you, I guess.
Yeah. So that's
Craig, are you really debugging the chat room, or is something just strange going on?
No. We're having a problem with the sound in the chat room, and I'm just asking some of the users to test it for me. That's all.
Oh, okay.
So do you understand now the difference between a 64 and a 32-bit operating system?
And PAE, which I never thought I'd need to know.
See what you learn on the Computer America show.
There I know.
There it is. Okay, there you go.
Fun and educational.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So let's continue on with Saj. I think it's Saji.
Shoji, I think is the way you would pronounce it. Okay. And Shoji, him or her, I'm not sure which, has a problem with podcast receiving software GPodder, the stuff that we talked about a couple of Linux shows ago. Uh-huh. Shoji writes, "Hi, Larry, Tom, and Bill. I really enjoy listening to your show. Thank you so much for all your work. I have a problem with GPodder on Linux Mint 12. I have been using GPodder on my main desktop PC, which is running Ubuntu 11.10. GPodder works just fine on Ubuntu, but when I tried to use GPodder on my Linux Mint 12 laptop, GPodder just doesn't work. First, I installed GPodder from the Synaptic Software Manager and uninstalled it. but the laptop crashed every time I started GPotter. So I installed Ubuntu Software Center, tried to install it from there, but the same thing. GPotter crashed and didn't work. Then I thought maybe GPotter doesn't like my Toshiba laptop. I installed Mint 12 on my desktop PC alongside Ubuntu. Mm-hmm. GPotter still didn't work with Linux Mint 12. Larry, you have said you've been using both Mint 12 and GPotter. Have you had any problem with GPotter on your Mint 12? By the way, I'm running Linux Mint 32-bit on my laptop and tried Linux Mint 64-bit on my desktop PC. Thank you, show from Chicago, Illinois.
There you go.
And in answer to your question, no, I haven't had a problem. And I'm not really sure what could be going on here. It definitely points to a problem with Linux Mint. And since I'm not seeing the problem, and I don't see a lot of posts in the forums about problems with GPotter on Linux Mint, which, you know, you would expect to see that if there was a real issue there, I'm suspecting that you're installing Linux Mint 12 from either a thumb drive or a CD or a CD-ROM that you've created, and perhaps there's something wrong with your Linux Mint installation media. So it may not have downloaded properly. It may not have burned properly onto the CD if you're using a CD. So I would try downloading another version, you know, downloading another CD or image and try reinstalling it again. I'm really not hopeful that that's going to solve your problem, because you did get GPotter both from the Synaptic Package Manager, which reaches into the Mint repositories, and then you installed the Ubuntu Software Center, which probably you didn't have to do to get to what you wanted, but it would have worked. That reaches into the Ubuntu repositories, and so you were pulling down two completely independent versions. I'm assuming they're independent versions of GPotter, and installing them. Another thing you might try, if you haven't tried it, is go to the GPotter site itself and download the Linux version from there, mm-hmm, for Ubuntu or Linux Mint, and that will work on Linux Mint, since Mint is based on Ubuntu and they do share the same many of the same applications out of the box. Typically, an Ubuntu version of a software package will work on Linux Mint without any changes at all. So give that a try. If that doesn't work, write back. I'm eager to help you if our suggestions haven't helped at this point. But give it a try and let us know how it goes.
There you go. All right. So, show, I think hopefully that, mm-hmm, will help you out. And again,
you just give Shoji a nickname?
No, Shoji says show, S-H-O, from Chicago.
Oh, okay. Never mind. He gave himself a nickname.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break, and this is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. When we come back, we're going to talk about Lone Star. He has a question about something called VirtualBox, and we'll address that email as well. This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. Stay with us. We'll be right back. But, you know, I think it's a peculiarity of certain computer systems when the sound is on. For example, Jack Des says he can't hear the welcome sound, but we all hear it when he comes in. So go figure. You know, I know Jack is using Linux, and I'm sure maybe he needs to configure.
Maybe the chat room isn't happy to see him.
It could be.
That may be. So, it's certainly happy to see me, because I get the welcome message when I log in with my Linux system.
Yep, that's it. So anyhow, let's continue on with the Lone Star. Okay, 17.
Okay. So Lone Star has a question about VirtualBox and an explanation of what VirtualBox is. It's something that Sun Microsystems developed. I think they developed it. Certainly they have been the most recent owners of that technology until Oracle purchased Sun Microsystems, and now it's known as Oracle VirtualBox. And what it is it's software that allows you to run one operating system inside of another. So from the Linux perspective, while running Linux, you can install VirtualBox. And then within VirtualBox, you can be running Windows or another version of Linux or any other operating system that you could install on your computer hardware. And so that gives you a great playground for being able to try out Linux distributions, for example, without having to install them on your real hardware. Because when you're finished with a virtual environment, to get rid of it, all you have to do is delete the file because it's all included in a file.
Yeah.
So that's what VirtualBox is, and VirtualBox is available for Windows and Linux and Mac, and VMware is another version of virtualization software that is very popular as well. And so Lone Star 17 writes, "Hi Larry, Tom, and Bill. Haven't had to bother you for some time. That's good.
Yeah.
I just upgraded my VirtualBox version to current. Now my Mint 11 distribution will not go full screen as my Ubuntu 11.10 does. Usually that's due to guest editions not installed or installed incorrectly. Guest editions is an add-on for VirtualBox that allows some additional features. I've reinstalled them, and they say they are installed okay. I don't know where else to check. One question. Does one installation of VirtualBox cover all instances of OSs one has installed? I noticed while researching Mint wouldn't go full screen. One area of the VDI, virtual desktop interface, I guess, it said my guest editions were tied to Ubuntu 11.10. Everything works fine in Ubuntu, and it was the first distribution installed. Perhaps that's the explanation. How should that affect Mint? Thanks, Larry, for help and suggestions." Well, Lone Star, the VirtualBox guest editions, maybe you've installed a specific version for Ubuntu, and that may be what's causing your problem there. So you might want to just go to the Oracle website for VirtualBox and ensure that you're getting the guest editions from them. Also, if that doesn't work, make sure that the VirtualBox that you're installing is the Oracle VirtualBox. There are several different versions of it, some of them older from Sun Microsystems that may not be compatible with the current guest editions. So those are some things to think about, some things to try out. And as always, write back if you're still having problems.
Okay, good. And I think we have time for one final email. We've covered a lot tonight, I gotta say,
We have. We really have. So our last email is from Bob, who has some words of encouragement. "Hi, Larry, Tom, and Bill. I've been a listener from the early days and enjoy your shows. I've been doing some catch-up after a rather busy 2 months and got to listen to episode 167 today. I was happy to hear Bill mention his delight with PC Linux OS, distribution of Linux. I stumbled on PC Linux OS about 6 years ago while experimenting with numerous live CDs. PC Linux OS just seemed to fit. It worked out of the box, has a great community, and I absolutely love the rolling release approach. I'm not doing the six-month upgrade with a prayer or reinstall shuffle."
What is a rolling release? In other words, it's an ongoing release?
Yeah. Okay. So instead of having to install a new version when they upgrade, they just send out the upgrades through the upgrade manager
or
the
nice.
Update manager. Yeah. Okay. So you just get them trickled out to you.
That's nice.
Yeah, and many distributions are doing that these days.
Yeah, well, on Mac OS X, that's what happens. They have the distribution, the software update just updates it for you, you know.
Right, right. Exactly. And so the way that works is instead of going from Lion to Mountain Lion, right, you would just get the releases, you know, the updates pushed to you.
That's right.
Exactly. That's the way this works with the rolling release.
There you go.
So the distro is not always cutting edge. It's the stable version, or stable edge, rather. The devs don't release new packages on a schedule. They release them when they are ready to be released. On the other hand, we often have the latest release of Firefox or LibreOffice the day it comes out.
By the way, one correction, on the Mac, they do updates, but not upgrades. In other words, when they come out with a major version, then you have to purchase it for $29 or something like
that. Okay. And so there's the distinction with a rolling release. It would be the equivalent of getting your upgrade pushed to you.
Got it. Okay. Continue on.
Okay. So along with my single boot desktop, I am actually running the full KDE version on an old Triple EPC 900 netbook with zero problems. Okay, it has 2 gigabytes of RAM, so that helps a bit. But a 900 megahertz processor, the graphics chip on the netbook does not allow me to have full KWin effects. But hey, it's a netbook. Hang in there with PC Linux OS. Enjoy the ride. Maybe the various community flavors. Maybe try the various community flavors. Thanks, Larry, Tom, and Bill.
And there you go. And I'm going to have to thank you, too, because we are flat out of time.
What is the next version?
What's coming up next with the Going Linux
Listener
podcast?
Feedback. We've got more emails and more help for our listeners.
Excellent. This is always a pleasure having you here on the show, Larry. And we will see you here next month. Same time, same bat channel, okay?
Sounds great to me. I'll be here.
All right. You take care. Have a good evening. Good night.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.